On Mondays, we talk to our Hollywood guru, Michael Warshauer, as he gives us all the latest TV, movies, entertainment, streaming, anything in the entertainment platform you can really get your hands on. We always turn to Michael to give us the latest. Michael, how are you, man? How was the 4th of July weekend for you?
Oh, it was great. So much great stuff to watch. You know, you had Hamilton this weekend, so many good things. So excited to be through on the other end and some more things to watch.
Very cool. Very cool. Yeah, Hamilton, I've seen a lot floating around about that. A lot of people wanting to know, you know, what the original cast is up to now. You know, that's a play that I am yet to see Hamilton, but I hear nothing but great things about it. Is that something you'd recommend for me, Michael?
Absolutely. I think, you know, it was one of those sort of cultural touchstones when it came out about 5 years ago, and has obviously sort of only grown in esteem since then. So I think it's one of those things that you certainly should check out at least once to get a taste of what all the hype is about, and I think it's certainly worth all that hype.
Okay, good deal, good deal. Well, I want to start here, something I have seen plenty of, and that's The Office, and this interesting, I guess you could call it a story, kind of emerging. John Krasinski, who played Jim, apparently he was wearing a wig throughout certain episodes or seasons, I guess. What are you able to tell me about this?
Well, this is pretty wild. I got to admit that when I first saw this headline, my first reaction was, there's no way that a guy with that head of hair actually needed a wig. But it turns out the story came from a new book by the author Andy Green. It's called The Office, The Untold Story of the Greatest Sitcom of the 2000s. And essentially, during season 3, John Krasinski was offered a part in a movie called Leatherheads that was written and directed by George Clooney, who also starred in it alongside Renee Zellweger. You'd be forgiven if you forgot about this movie. It was kind of a flop and not really loved by critics when it came out, but it was a huge career opportunity for John Krasinski at the time. He was still building on the reputation of The Office and starting to become the star that he is today. But back then, that was a huge chance. And contractually, he was not allowed to cut his hair into a 1920s hairstyle that was required for the movie because of The Office. And he went to producer Greg Daniels and spoke to him, and Greg Daniels said, "I'm sorry, we just can't do it." I mean, if you have watched The Office, you know that certainly in those early seasons, Jim's kind of moppy hair is sort of his a big part of his character, so they said no. But John Krasinski really wanted this role, so he went out and hired a hair and makeup person to make a wig for him, which is definitely not cheap, but he put it on, and he actually went to set, filmed a scene for The Office for the 3rd season in the wig without telling anybody that he had done it, and then went into Greg Daniels' office, had a full conversation with him, and in the middle of it, took the hairpiece out and revealed that it was a wig, and that was his way that he convinced them to do it. A pretty amazing story, and really one that only the star of a very, very popular TV show could get away with. So for any aspiring actors out there, make sure you're still asking before doing that. But when you have that kind of pull on a series, you can get away with it. And clearly, we've gone so many years, about 10 years now, without noticing it. So a pretty good wig, if you ask me.
Wow. I would have never guessed that, man. That's absolutely wild. And you nailed it, too. Yeah, that's not something that not any old actor can just pull that off and get away with it. No, I think you got to be you got to have quite the clout to be able to do that. So very cool. John Krasinski's career has really, I think, taken a nice step forward over the last couple of years. I forget what the movie was called, but there was one, and it was kind of like a post-apocalyptic type thing. There was a lot of jump scares in it. I don't know if you know what I'm talking about.
A Quiet Place.
Yes, thank you. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was awesome. A Quiet Place was awesome. It was a much more serious role for him, obviously. I thought that was pretty cool. So I like where his career is going right now. Next thing I wanted to hit on here, The Babysitter's Club. I've been looking into this a little bit, didn't know a whole lot about it until I saw a couple people talking about it on Twitter this past weekend, but seeing a lot of good things. Some people seem a bit wary getting into it. What's this show all about, and is this something we're checking out?
It has gotten really great reviews. Obviously, Netflix bringing it back, this was really sort of a big series, certainly for, I think, 90s kids in particular. But it's a whole new take on it, sort of in the vein of a lot of shows we've seen throughout the years. It has a much more diverse cast and has sort of done a better job of, giving a more modern representation of teenage girls than the original series, which and even the 1995 film, as well. So it's pretty neat that I think that they're telling sort of some really nuanced stories for teenage girls that's so accessible on Netflix. This was a series that, when I was that age, about 13 or so, like it wasn't necessarily a big deal for me, but I know so many of my friends that it meant so much to them, and so it's really neat to see it coming back to a new generation. And like I said, it's been getting rave reviews. Across the TV critics world, they are all enjoying it, and I think this is definitely a show to check out. It's certainly, if you have teenagers, one to encourage them to watch, absolutely. But I think it's really neat. It's another instance of, similar to the One Day at a Time reboot that Netflix had, a chance to take a property that everyone knows and loves so well and bring a lot of more modern issues and takes into it and really do some very compelling story with the format that we already know. So definitely one to check out if you were certainly a fan of the original or just looking for something great to watch.
Well, good to hear that you are backing the show, because I know a lot of these reboots, it seems like everybody does them today, right? So it kind of gets watered down, the effect of, oh, wow, there's a reboot there. But if it's done right, I think a lot of these shows, their reboots can turn out really well. And this seems to be the latest example of that. Moving right along here, Tom Cruise and the Mission Impossible crew, apparently they've gotten permission now from the British government to resume filming, although it'll be in kind of a quarantine bubble. So I don't know how much you know about this, but to me, it seems something similar to what the NBA is doing in Orlando, where everybody just kind of has to stay in this close-quartered bubble and they can't really leave or do anything else. So kind of a two-parter here. Is this something that Cruise can do moving forward? And how big of an impact does this maybe have on some of the bigger stars? Like you mentioned there with John Krasinski doing two things at once. Does that kind of eliminate that?
I think to answer that second question, I think absolutely. I know one of the major elements to this is that basically the UK has announced new guidelines specifically allowing cast and crew to travel to the country without quarantining, but exactly like in the NBA, being in that bubble, you're pretty much going from your hotel to filming locations, and that's it. It seems to be mostly motivated by getting the UK film industry jump-started. It is obviously a major industry there, but it's not quite as massive as it is here. It's still around a $50, $60 billion a year industry, so that's a lot of money for the UK economy. So I think there's a lot of that sort of motivation behind it. I know that Jurassic World Dominion has also resumed filming over there. It's really been an interesting conversation that's been had in the industry over the last few months. I was actually just talking to my cousin, who's a member of the Screen Actors Guild, about some of the steps that they're taking and some of the guidelines that they have for moving forward. And essentially what we're seeing is a lot of different tiers of crew being reorganized into sort of groups so that they can sort of manage them. So you have your cameramen, your lighting guys, your actors, directors, all in one category. You have your makeup and costume and prop people in another one. And so you just sort of have these tiers, and they're able to basically help mediate who goes in between those different groups to help prevent the potential spread of COVID if it were to come onto a film set. So, sort of like every industry, and it's very similar, I think you nailed it, to sport. There's just so many questions and so many things that we're figuring out on the fly. So it would not surprise me to start to see production really start to resume both here in the States and abroad over the next few months with a lot of these precautions in place. But at the same time, I also see it very possible that they're going to be working with skeleton crews, really just like the bare essential people that they need, and eventually possibly seeing even production shut down if there is a confirmed case or if there is a further spread into the industry. So That's a concern, but I absolutely think that both cast and crew are going to start working exclusively on sort of one project at a time. It'll be a lot harder for TV stars necessarily to go and film a movie during their break without taking a lot of precautions and tests and that kind of thing. But I'd say overall, I think we're starting to head into the direction of having production start up, certainly on some of these really large productions like a Mission Impossible or a Jurassic World or those kinds of things, which are doing major business at the box office and really employing a lot of people. So certainly something to look forward to. I can say just personally, the Mission Impossible series is one of my favorite action franchises, so I cannot wait to have that back. But hopefully we'll start to get some more of these big movies in production here soon.
Now, I implore your forgiveness here, Michael, but I have never seen any of the Mission Impossible movies. I apologize now for that. your raving review right there, because I know, I mean, some people definitely credit them for being like great action movies. I don't know, like, sure. I get the occasional bad opinion on it, and I don't know where that really stems from some of the people I talk to, but definitely something worth checking out, I think. Moving right
100%.
Along. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no, I agree. Check them out.
Well, I will definitely have to do that. I'll have plenty of free time this upcoming weekend, actually, so maybe I'll pencil that in. Westworld's Jonathan Nolan and Lisa Joy developing this Fallout series for Amazon, and this is cool for me because I'm a big video game person. Not in love with the Fallout games by any stretch, but I've enjoyed some of them over the years. What can you tell me about this show?
This is another in a long line of video game adaptations that are starting to pop up on TV and streaming. Earlier this year, we had Netflix's version of The Witcher. Showtime's been working on a Halo series for several years. And just earlier this year, HBO signed a production deal to do a series based on The Last of Us video game series, which just had its second installment drop to a lot of attention and reviews. So it's becoming a trend to sort of turn these video game series, which really have sort of a cinematic base to them that sort of started with very cinematic cutscenes and elements to them, turning into full-on series. This series sounds very exciting. I'm with you. I've played a couple of the Fallout games. I know the fourth one is certainly really fantastic, but the rest of them are somewhat uneven, but the plot of them is really great. It's basically like if 1950s nuclear age, like the dream of that was realized and people got nuclear-powered cars and nuclear-powered homes, but the Cold War still ended in a nuclear war. And so you have, on the surface, you have all of these bandits and mutants and settlements of people, and then usually the games have a character who was in a bunker and was in cryogenic sleep, waking up in the future to discover this brutal wasteland and trying to figure out a way to save humanity. So it really is kind of a perfect show to adapt. It's also a very darkly funny series. It sort of reminds me a lot of Dr. Strangelove in that it takes this very, very serious potential for a nuclear holocaust and turns it into something that's somewhat amusing. So I think it's great. And, I mean, obviously, Lisa Joy and Jonathan Nolan have been really experimenting a lot with the sci-fi genre with Westworld, which is a very unique beast unto itself and really has a unique voice. So I'm very excited to see what they do with it. I think there's a lot of potential. We'll see when this comes out. It was expected in 2021, but given all the delays we've seen around the pandemic, I would not be surprised to see it in 2022. But this is definitely one of the big highlight video game adaptations to be coming out in the next couple of years.
Well, whenever it does premiere, I know you will have a bottle of Nuka-Cola on hand, right?
100%, without a doubt.
There you go. Real quick before we get to our picks to click for the week, reading about this little this morning, legendary composer Ennio Morricone, and I apologize if I kind of butchered that last name there. He passed away at the age of 91. And from what I was reading, worked with Tarantino in some of his films, but more of a legend within Western films, doing the score for a lot of those movies. What kind of legacy does he leave behind? And another two-parter here, does the right score for a film kind of make or break it in some instances?
Well, to the first part, he is, I would say, one of the most legendary film composers of all time. I think I saw a tweet, and I'm sorry, I can't remember who it was, say he didn't invent the film score, but he kind of invented the film score. He was really one of the first major film composers to start really crafting iconic scores for movies. He did over 500 films over the course of his career. I think what he's perhaps most known for are the films that he did with his childhood friend, Sergio Leone, that were known as spaghetti westerns. I'm talking about the Clint Eastwood series specifically, Fistful of Dollars, A Few Dollars More, and of course The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. One of the most iconic film scores of all time. You know when you hear that you're about to see some sort of an Old West showdown. It really is just one of those music cues that will always stick with you, and you know exactly what it's for. But he worked on, like I said, 500 films throughout his career, really prolific. He was nominated for Oscars for the films Days of Heaven, The Untouchables, and Bugsy, before he finally won for The Hateful Eight, the Tarantino film, in 2015. Mm. He also did scores for John Carpenter's The Thing, Pedro Almodovar's Tie Me Up, Tie Me Down, and Franco Zeffirelli's Hamlet. Won several awards in Italy and Europe, but definitely a very iconic film composer who worked really up until the end of his life. So a major loss there. But, you know, as far as scores, I think that's a great question. But if you start thinking about some of the, you know, the more iconic film scores, you think of people like John Williams, Danny Elfman, Hans Zimmer, and you can sort of hear, like, you hear the Star Wars theme and you get that, you know, excitement in you and you know what it means. You hear the Indiana Jones theme and you know exactly what it is. And so there's just a number of really iconic film scores that sort of have you know, gone with their movies as being icons themselves. I can't imagine watching Star Wars again without that John Williams score. It's just an essential part of it. And I think to a certain degree, a lot of blockbusters have moved away from using really noteworthy scores. I know a lot of people have discussed the music in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. I know that there is, in particular, like the Avengers kind of music cue is certainly well known, and that's the one I always hear, when you think of a Marvel movie. But other than that, I'm not sure I could pick out a specific score for Iron Man or Thor or any of these other movies. They're just sort of really accompanying music and background music as opposed to a sort of dominant force the way the Indiana Jones theme is, or even the Jurassic Park music. You kind of know what movie that's attached to. So it's interesting to see how that sort of shifted over the last couple of years. I think it's definitely primed to have a comeback, to have some of these big ornate scores, but certainly lost a legend, and I know that the other three guys I mentioned earlier are certainly getting up there as well, so hopefully there's some more emerging composers that can fill that gap.
Yeah, wow, 500 movies, that is a heck of a career right there, no doubt about it. Well, real quick here, Michael, before we let you go, let's go over our picks to click for the week. What should we be keeping an eye on?
Absolutely. First, on Thursday on HBO Max is a new animated series called Close Enough. It comes from the creator of the animated series Regular Show, J.G. Clintel. It's a series that revolves around a millennial couple, their 5-year-old daughter, and their divorced friends who live with them in a Los Angeles duplex. So for animation fans, this should be a nice original series to check out this weekend. But then there's a great-looking movie that I'm excited for on Hulu coming out this weekend. It's a sort of sci-fi rom-com starring Andy Samberg and Kristen Milioti called Palm Springs, and it's about it's a stuck in a time loop. Two wedding guests develop a budding romance while living the same day over and over again. So it kind of has some Groundhog Day vibes to it, or Russian Doll, the Netflix series, if anyone watched that. But two very funny and great actors up front there. So that's what I'm looking forward to checking out this weekend. That comes out Friday on Hulu.
Well, Michael, that has me tickled pink over here because I love Regular Show and I love Andy Samberg. So I am very, very excited for this weekend. Now, Michael, thank you very much for taking some time on your Monday afternoon to give us the latest with entertainment. Look forward to talking with you again next week.
Sounds good. Thanks a lot.